Hi, I'm Lena Nguyen, a former New South Wales police lawyer.
And I'm Mark Davidson, a former police sniper and detective.
The lawyer, the sniper and the New South Wales police is our story, told in the hope that others who have come up against the entrenched culture of law enforcement from within might find ways to speak more openly. And then we can contribute to changing the system.
Our focus is on how the police responded in the aftermath of both of our stories. We're passionate about justice and determined to add our voices to the calls for change so no one else is discarded as we were.
We've spoken over four episodes of some of the details of our own experiences. So I really hope you've gotten to know us a bit better and have an understanding of the profoundly problematic structural flaws in the New South Wales Police Force as it handles abuse and disputes.
In this episode, we're joined by clinical psychologist Lynn Worsley to speak about complex traumas that followed for us and more broadly about the psychological effects of whistleblowing.
Lynn's the director of the Resilience Centre. She's a clinical psychologist and registered nurse with experience in teaching, youth work, early childhood, hospitals and correctional services.
While I was working as a nurse and a teacher, I was also doing youth work. So I have background in working in prisons and hospitals and teaching facilities and so on. So that actually then led me to wanting to do some more study. So I studied psychology and became a clinical psychologist and studied particularly in the area of resilience and what makes people survive and thrive in the face of adversity.
When you talk about resilience, can you tell us what you mean?
Okay, I can start telling you what it does not mean.
Okay.
So resilience is not a character trait or a personality trait. It's not a set of skills that you can learn to be resilient. It's actually a verb, a doing word. It's a process. Right. So resilience is a combination of three areas of people's lives, such as, I guess, the dynamic interaction of your own development of personal competence or professional competence at the same time as negotiating and navigating with the resources around you, like the people around you in your life, at the same time as going through adversity. So it's the combination of those three things and the interaction of those three things.
We'd like to talk to you about a resilient response to trauma. How do we have this discussion in a way that's helpful to those who suffer trauma and abuse while holding perpetrators accountable?
Okay, there's two parts to that. A resilience response to trauma comes across in different ways for different people. But the researchers have identified three different ways of a resilience response. The first one is like sustaining your life. So you might have gone through something that's really traumatic, but you get up and you just keep going and you do what you need to do. It doesn't mean that they're burying it. It just means that they have a response that is to sustain their life during the trauma. We see the studies of that with people who've been in sort of prisons of war camps where they've been in there a long time and they've been able to survive. Another way is that they might recover. A lot of our research came from the studies from the 9/11. They measured the cortisol levels of people around the 9/11 site and they came down really rapidly, which was interesting. And that bounce back recovery response is linked to the number of supports and resources around them in comparison to other events like Cyclone Katrina, for example, where resources weren't readily available straight away. So remember in the definition I gave you at the beginning that resilience is you're building up of your competence at the same time as you're navigating and negotiating with people around you and resources around you. The third way that we look at is growth. So we might talk about that as post-traumatic growth or something like that. Viktor Frankl noted this in the Second World War, in the prisons of war, where he noticed that those people who survived were the people who had a sense of meaning and purpose in their trauma and abuse. What can I learn despite the fact that this has happened to me? Now, those people have a recovery rate that is rapid and they come back to baseline very quickly. And so when we start working with somebody who is having a response to trauma, it's very helpful to actually get them to start thinking about, well, what does this mean for you? What's the meaning in your life? In 20 years' time, how would you like to look back on this and see what purpose it has served in your life?
So, Lynn, from that, I'm thinking about the accountabilities of perpetrators, and I wonder then, what role does holding them to account play in the journey of trauma recovery under this resilience model?
There are so many layers to that question. One of the most important things we've got to remember here is that when a victim has been traumatised, a resilient response is really helpful for us to be able to pick up on quickly. If there is a long, drawn-out court case where the perpetrator is denying that, and if everything is dependent on the perpetrator's accountability, it hinders the victim's recovery. It's like the perpetrator holds their soul. And in that situation, we need to separate it so that there's a sense of, let's work with the victim's recovery, the victim's understanding of their own resilient response, and let's look at their healing independent of the perpetrator's accountability. However, the other layer of that is, if we have accountable organisations that enable people who have been abused and hurt to have navigation and negotiation process that enables them to gather the resources they need in order to heal, that would mean that the perpetrator takes a back seat. So that might be in the workplace, that might be in the community, that might be in a wider society. If listening to the victim's response and giving them the honour that they need in order to heal, and not placing them in a victimised position where they're still a victim of the perpetrator's accountability. And also having perhaps the organisation's procedures and processes that are in place, that doesn't mean that the victim has to hold the perpetrator to account. It can be two independent processes. So it could be the organisation that has to hold them to account. It could also be the community that has to hold them to account. But the victim themselves needs to be into a position where they have to be independent of the perpetrator, otherwise they keep being abused.
I wanted to ask you, Lynn, about how we can talk about resilience and a resilient response to trauma and avoid blaming and shaming around not being resilient enough, especially in the work environment that Mark and I worked in, that there is a view or an acceptance of someone not recovering because they're not resilient enough or not tough enough.
I think really in the police or in any defence situation as well, there is a situation where we're wanting people to be tough. And so what we have is a culture that has been developed around the idea of toughness and not expressing your own emotions and not feeling things. And if something goes wrong, you can blame and shame somebody else. And let's just, you know, protect ourselves and protect our organisation and put ourselves above the others. What we need in this day and age is to be able to use our resilient response and our recovery well to show that actually we need to work with people to maintain their integrity. We need to work with people to be able to maintain their values and their reason and their purpose for being here, so that when things happen to them that are difficult, we're able to then go, how can we help you to recover quickly because you're a very good worker and we want you back on the field? Rather than, oh, you're not good enough, you've shown some cracks, so off we send you to somewhere else so that we can blame you for something going wrong and we don't want to take a risk.
Lynn, can you talk a bit about, from a psychological perspective, the idea of tribe or cliques in workplaces that where colleagues work closely together and trust is integral?
The idea of tribe is a concept that is almost like the humanity itself needs to be in a tribe, needs to be in a group.
Yep.
We find people that are like-minded. We look for people who are similar to us. It makes us feel good. It makes us feel comfortable. And when you're in a situation that is difficult and you're facing a difficult world, then you find a tribe that helps you to stay safe. So in the police, for example, what's really important is that we have a tribe that we all think the same because we're separate to everyone else. We're above everyone else. We can arrest them. We can call on the law. We can do things to actually make others feel like they're frightened of us. So that doesn't make us feel very good about ourselves. So we hang around in a tribe to give us that sense of security as people. So that's a natural and normal process. And we tend to find that that makes us a little bit closed. If we're really worried about what other people think about us, we can actually stay in our little tribe and our little groups and not expand our worldview.
Yep.
And it might mean that we're stuck, but it's safe. So tribes are helpful to maintain our sanity and safety.
And police work is different, isn't it? Partly because of the critical element of trust between people who may not like each other, and partly because of the risky nature of the work and the intensity of it. What do you think are the special considerations that need to be taken into account when thinking about the general impact of working within such a place?
This is really tapping into the development of moral reasoning. So let me just take you on a little bit of a journey in this one. So when we're exposed to different ways of thinking, we open our worldview. When we're exposed to only one way of thinking, we close down our worldview. So when we look at the stages of moral reasoning, the first stage of moral reasoning is where someone is, you know, like a little child is born into a world and they think that the whole world has been on freeze hold until they arrive. And then everybody's looking at them and they think they're the center of the universe. Now, it's pretty cute when you're, you know, one or two, but it's not cute when you're 40. But the next stage is you're no longer at the top of the tree, you're no longer the main person in the world, you are part of a group, and that group becomes a group thinking model. You're in a group and you fit with the group and you do a whole lot of things to make that group like you. So you change your behaviour. It doesn't necessarily look like we've developed much, but we've at least taken ourselves away from thinking that we're the only people on the planet. We now think that the group is the only people in the planet. Then the third stage is where you can develop a sense of compassion and you can see other people for who they are and you want universal moral values and justice for all people. Now, that's what I would hope all of us aspire to. But what we know with moral reasoning is that it's not a developmental process that just occurs because we get older. So if we are closed down and we're in a group and we're stuck in a group and that group becomes our own place of safety and they think like us and so on, then we will get stuck in the second stage. And at any time, if somebody steps out of the group, we won't protect them because we're looking after ourselves. We are actually in that first stage of moral reasoning. In adulthood, we call it the narcissistic personality. But what we do know is that when people go through trauma, that means if I go outside of that culture, they're not going to protect me and be all the time worrying about your back, all the time trying to protect yourself, all the time watching out in case somebody hurts you. So it's in that first stage is very much a black and white thinking, cause and effect, blame and shame.
So there's some really interesting points you've just raised, Lynn, and from talking from my own experience, it could be, could it not, that the New South Wales Police might be experiencing one or more of those phases that you're talking about as an organisation, I mean?
Yeah, I think as an organisation, we've seen a lot of really good changes happened in the police, but the culture itself is also set up to be a law and order culture. So we've got a dichotomy going on. So there's a sense that there are individuals in the organisation who are there because they really, really want to make some difference in the world, because they believe in what they're doing. Now, if they are able to use that third stage in the way that they're interacting with the people around them. That's brilliant. But if what happens that as soon as they step out in that third stage and stand up for their moral values, if they do that and they're reprimanded, that's countercultural. If the culture itself is you don't stick your neck out, you just follow the rules, you do as you're told, you shut up if something's happened to you, then basically we've got a situation where nothing can change. So the first stage is very fixed and very hard to deal with if you want to make a change.
Yeah, well, in our experience, the New South Wales Police has a culture of leaning towards, I'd say, self-congratulation or slapping each other on the back and maybe not necessarily digging into and acknowledging errors that have been made along the way. What do you think that could mean for officers in the broader community? A lot of the time in the debriefs that I've been part of in the past, all they focused on was the end result, which was the arrest of the individual. And I'd try to raise, oh, hang on a sec, what about so-and-so nearly had a car accident, so-and-so nearly maybe accidentally discharged their firearm. Like, these are errors that we need to talk about so they don't happen again, but that never really wanted to get acknowledged or talked about because I was dampening their successful, operation.
So what you're raising there, Mark, is a really good example of if you're in that first stage, it's black and white, you're right or you're wrong. And so you don't want to be wrong, so you work out all the things that you're right so you don't have to get into trouble. So it's black and white.
Yeah.
I'm avoiding getting into trouble. I'm going to do whatever I can to avoid that, and also I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that everyone praises me. And so I'm about me. It's all about me doing well or not getting into trouble. And what you're saying here is a sense of like, well, we're not going to say whether we're right or wrong, but could we have done it better? So when you have a blame and shame culture, it shuts down any sense of growth mindset.
Yeah, so Lynn, in work cultures such as these, what are the psychological impacts on those who actually speak up about wrongdoing and actually in effect become whistleblowers?
I think, first of all, the difficulty with using the term whistleblowers implies that they are buying into the blame and shame culture. Mm-hmm. So what we need to be aware of here is that person who is saying, actually, I think things need to improve, or this is not going the way we want it to go, and we want accountability in there. So when we start thinking about that, people who call that out then are often at odds with those who are busy protecting themselves.
Yeah, well, conforming to the crowd builds rapport with the crowd. So
that's correct.
As soon as you stop doing that.
That's right.
You're going to lose that rapport pretty quick.
Yes. So I guess in a sense what we need in work culture is an ability to, we need people to have the voice to be able to go, oh yeah, that's a good idea or we should change that. They can't do that until they have an attitude that they're not protecting themselves. So the psychological impact of somebody who is outside of the group is aloneness, isolation. They doubt themselves. They think maybe I was wrong all along. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. Maybe I really wasn't abused. Maybe something I did was wrong. So there's a sense of like, oh my goodness, I'm wrong because the crowd doesn't agree with me and the group that I've been in doesn't agree with me. So the massive self-doubt that comes in there is that they recoil. Like, oh, maybe it didn't happen. Well, actually, it did happen. So in that situation, the psychological impact of self-doubt is so big that you often see somebody just pulling away and they're feeling almost like persecuted. And when you're in a position where you feel persecuted, you don't trust anybody.
So then just generally speaking, I'd like to know your thoughts on or your opinion on complex PTSD and how that manifests in general terms for many people that have worked in traumatic and stressful environments or seen traumatic things.
I think it's important to say it's not necessarily an emotional state.
Oh, okay.
So post-traumatic stress happens post. So it's an after event. So there are different ways for different people to actually show PTSD. But what we do know is that people who've been in frontline services, for example, they learn to manage watching difficult things. They have what you call vicarious trauma. So they'll look at traumatic incidents and either filter it by having a professional response to it. And over time, their skills get better and better. However, there gets to a point when there may be a shutdown response or a click-off response. And I think that might happen where someone is just goes into a monotone and they just may not actually have a sense of feeling where they're in the place at the time, and they have it like a dissociative experience, so they are outside of their body. And that may happen for a while, and it may just all of a sudden just exacerbate in terms of having flashbacks of events, not just the one event, but multiple events. Yep. They may have an extreme reaction to, say, a car driving past and the exhaust letting off a big bang, and they just dive under the table without knowing why they did that. And what happens is that the adrenal glands have been pumping out cortisone to try and keep them in this hypervigilant space, because they're all the time exposed to seeing traumatic events or being involved with them or having to be vigilant and on guard, such as your job. Then all of a sudden, the cortisol's run out. The brain then goes, oh my goodness, we've got no juice, so we'll just have to up our sympathetic nervous system response. And that is then to panic, to, you know, not be able to breathe properly, not sleeping, and doing a whole lot of things that are just outside of what you would normally do. And they may not be able to concentrate, they may not be able to think straight, they may not be able to make decisions, to sleep well, or they might be sleeping too much, just almost like as a big change in their personality. So what we've got is an organisation that needs to have people with high cortisol levels. They need to have things going, they need to be vigilant, hypervigilant, because we want them to be on a stress zone, because you perform better when you're a bit stressed. But what needs to happen in an organisation is to be able to help people to release the valve of stress a little bit, to keep them so that they can come back to baseline a bit and then come back up again when they need to. The body doesn't cope with having high cortisol for a long time. So over time, their bodies wear out. They have heart complaints. They have difficulties with diet and exercise and sleep and so on. So we've got to be able to have an organisation that enables people to let the valve out and take a bit of time out. Now, that's not because they're not coping. Mm. It just should be something that is enabled to do on a regular basis. Now, if you're an athlete, one of the things would happen is that you'd have what you call lactic acid would be pumping through your system. And if you don't go and do something to relieve that lactic acid, you can hardly move the next day. Well, it's the same thing with cortisol. So in some ways, it's almost like changing up or moving them around their organisation so they can do other things that aren't necessarily high level. That means that, okay, we're going to take you off frontline for, you know, a week and put you on this. It may be that you're managing the phones or the call-in for a week. It may be that you're doing detective work for a week. Those things are less traumatizing, but they're still keeping you within the workforce.
Well, coincidentally, that's what happened to me. When I felt my mental health declining and symptoms started to ramp up, I went to my boss at the time and asked, quite unknowingly why, I asked him if I could be transferred back to the detective's office. And he said, for whatever reason, that couldn't occur and I needed to hang in there for 6 months at least. And I think I said to him, I'm not going to make 6 months, you know. So it makes sense now why I was seeking that other meaningful work.
Now, what you actually did was you went to your boss and you said, I'm struggling, but I actually need to stay at work because work is good for me.
Hmm.
And that wasn't heard, unfortunately, and possibly for ignorance. Not necessarily because they're wanting to do something bad to you, but just not knowing the best way to heal you.
Mm. Lynn, so there was the trauma that I suffered when I was prevented from going back to my job and then excluded and isolated and then eventually losing my job. There was that trauma, and then there was the trauma of the sexual assault itself. Can you explain how those two traumas differ?
They're very, very different. We often say the scientific principle, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And in psychological circles, we talk about the reaction as being sometimes worse than the actual action in the first place. So what happened to you should never have happened, ever. And it wasn't your fault. And you didn't cause that. What happened to you went into your episodic memory. It was an episode that gets stuck because it was so wrong and so much that was out of your control. What happened in that process was to be able to try and come to terms with something that was unbelievable in yourself. So you would have had a lot of self-doubt because it's an unbelievable situation. You would have had a response that meant that you didn't quite know how to relay what had happened to you. You couldn't believe what was happening to you. So you would have had a traumatic response. What happened in the situation afterwards is the reaction, the external reaction. So when we work with healing, we try and move away from the reaction and just go back to the trauma itself. But the difficulty for you is that you are having to deal with both at the same time. If they didn't react in such a way marginalised you and put you to one side, well, you'd probably heal a lot better. You'd heal quicker. Would you be performing better? Yeah, you'd be performing much better. And you'd be the person that they needed you to be in the organisation. But because they also have reactions to the situation, their reactions are human reactions. And human reactions of, I've got to cover my back, I might get into trouble. Human reactions of, in this culture, if I admit I did something wrong, then I'm going to be struck off, I've got to cover myself, and so on. So you're having to deal with the trauma of what happened to you that should never, ever, ever have happened to you, at the same time as deal with other people's unbelievable reaction to that. And I think you're doing it very well, but I don't think it's useful in terms of your humanity. But it's really important to say, I need to make a difference somehow here and sit in that third stage of moral development and go, I'm making a difference here for other people so it doesn't happen to other people and there's a better understanding, because that gives me a sense of healing under both.
What a perfect place to leave this part of the conversation. And thanks to Lynn Worsley from Sydney's Resilience Centre for her time.
We'll speak more with Lynn in Episode 8, where we gather suggestions for how the New South Wales Police can change its approach, and she offers ways for whistleblowers to cope with the fallout.
But in our next episode, we'll get some perspective on New South Wales Police culture with veteran journalist and expert in anti-corruption, Quentin Dempster.
A couple of good places to head if you need advice in any area we've discussed is Whistleblowers Australia. Or if you've experienced sexual assault or any kind of family or domestic violence, call the National Counselling Hotline on 1800 737 732. That's 1-800-RESPECT.
The show today was devised by us, Mark Davidson and Lena Nguyen. The executive producer is Gretchen Miller, with sound engineering from Judy Rapley. Thanks so much for listening. Bye for now.